welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be talking to Melanie Tannenbaum about benevolent sexism, what it is, and why it's harmful. Boston College is trying to stop students from giving free condoms to each other, and a federal judge has ordered the HHS to approve over-the-counter sales of Plan B without restrictions. Rachel Maddow had a great 10-minute segment recently about how out of control the right-wing legislation frenzy really is getting.
In Arkansas and in North Dakota this year, Republicans are also just flat out passing unconstitutional bans on abortion, as if Roe versus Wade just didn't exist. They're just banning abortion at the state level. Just try and stop them. Arkansas Republicans are essentially in a frenzy this year, because in Arkansas, Republicans took control of both houses of the state legislature in this past election for the first time since 74. And I don't mean 1974. I mean 1874, since the Reconstruction era after the end of the Civil War. And when you have not had control of something since 1874 and you get control of it, I guess you just, yee-haw, let's ban abortion. Who cares? Also, they've gotten right down to work to make clear that Arkansas rejects the Equal Rights Amendment. This is a headline from this week.
It's truly stunning when you step back and look at it, because literally we're talking about a small minority of Americans who couldn't be more out of touch with how the overwhelming majority of Americans live their lives. And yet, through complex manipulations of the political system, they have an outsized amount of power. The year is 2013 and they're coming for your birth control. Apparently, Boston College, a Catholic university, isn't content simply not to have their own health services pass out condoms or to have a website that admonishes students to abstain. Now, they've decided that it's critical to actively interfere with efforts to help students in need get access to condoms. A local news anchor explained what's going on.
Yeah, so those students were actually giving out condoms from their dorm room, an action that is frowned upon by Boston College officials. Now the school is threatening to take disciplinary action. So on BC's campus, there are student-run so-called safe sites. Those are locations where free condoms and safe sex information are available to those students.
To be clear, these condoms are not provided or distributed by the school. This is an initiative the students take on for themselves, getting assistance from outside organizations. The group is unofficial. They run this program out of their rooms and out on the sidewalk. This is something to consider in light of anti-choice claims that they oppose the Affordable Care Act's contraception mandate because they don't want the schools to, quote-unquote, pay for other people's contraception because it violates their religious beliefs. Set aside the claim that a school has a right to control how the compensation it provides to employees is spent. If the concern is not that contraception exists and is being used, but some kind of concern about complicity in its use, then this program should be unassailable, correct? The school is not paying for it or even endorsing it. It's the equivalent of any random student giving another student a gift. But the school has decided that if the gift I give you is the gift of safe sex, then they have a right to prevent that.
Last week, students got a letter from one of the deans saying, should we receive any reports that you are in fact distributing condoms on campus, the matter would be referred to the Student Conduct Office for disciplinary action.
So the university has stated that it's against the rules for a private student acting of their own accord to give another private student a gift if the gift somehow violates religious beliefs of the schools, though not obviously of the students. Got it. So how far are they willing to take this? Once you've decided you get to control what one student gives to another, why limit it to condoms and safe sex information? What if the school disapproves of a certain book, maybe one that criticizes Catholicism? Are you allowed to ban lending of that book? Why is giving a condom away the breaking point? Will simply having condoms on your person be the next rule infraction? That's how serious they are about making sure that student sex is unprotected. They're interfering with the private choices of students. The BS is running thick on this one.
University leaders say they also recognize that many students may not agree with the church's position on these types of issues. But they also say there are certain Catholic commitments that BC is asked to uphold.
they respect that students may disagree with them on this, but they'll be forcing the students to live by their values anyway. This is a clear-cut violation of the students' freedom of religion. The university is literally telling students that, in their private interactions that have nothing to do with the university, they are not allowed to choose to act according to their religious beliefs that allow for condom use. Even the tortured logic behind denouncing the contraception mandate isn't in play here. This is a straightforward claim by the university that they have a right to get into the students' private business. I don't even know why they bother with the pretense about distribution at this point. They clearly just want to treat condoms like contraband and are looking for any angle where they can chip away at student rights. The ACLU has threatened to sue if the students are punished for distributing condoms, and the college is not going to have an easy time defending itself against such a lawsuit. I'd like to welcome Melanie Tannenbaum to the program. Melanie is a doctoral candidate in social psychology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and a blogger at Scientific American. She's here today because she wrote a great and inadvertently timely post for Scientific American about benevolent sexism titled, "The Problem When Sexism Just Sounds So Darn Friendly." Welcome to RealityCast, Melanie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be speaking with you.
So let's talk about this concept of benevolent sexism. What is it and why is it so damaging?
Sure. So I will start by contrasting it with what we often think of when we think of sexism, which is within the context of social psychology, now referred to as hostile sexism, which is broadly very apparently aggressive or violent or malicious statements or attitudes about particularly women. For example, things like women are incompetent or could not hold powerful positions because they aren't as smart as men, things like that that are very obviously damaging and negative. But a couple of decades ago, research on ambivalent sexism revealed another side to the coin, which is this idea of benevolent sexism, which, as it sounds, includes statements that sound objectively positive, but still serve to basically undermine women's roles or paint them as subordinate in some way. And this doesn't need to be intentionally meant to subordinate women, so it doesn't have to be an intentional act of trying to push women down, but rather chivalrous attitudes like women should be protected, women should be idealized or put on a pedestal or protected like delicate flowers, even though they might sound objectively nice, still paint women in this way that is actually quite weak and frail and not self-sufficient. So it can serve to perpetuate these negative gender stereotypes and this idea that women are somehow lesser than men because of this idea that they need to be protected or looked after in some way or are just in some way different. And to get at the second part of what you said, the reason why this is potentially very harmful is because it hides in this tricky disguise of sounding objectively kind. So a lot of the times when women, especially in contemporary society where outright traditional prejudice is not as socially sanctioned as it once was, when you hear something that's obviously hostile, it's very easy to dismiss it or even get angry and act against it. But when you hear something that sounds objectively positive, it becomes much harder to fight it. It just sounds like a compliment. And in this way, it can sort of sneak under the skin and perpetuate gender inequality without people necessarily getting up in arms about it and fighting against it.
So what does the research show is the relationship between benevolent sexism and hostile sexism?
They tend to correlate fairly highly, so that's another misconception that I think people tend to have when they first hear about this idea of benevolent sexism, is the idea that it would be a zero-sum sort of game where people either endorse one or the other. And the fact is that in countries where you see high levels of hostile sexism being endorsed, you actually tend to see very high levels of benevolent sexism as well. You can see how these ideologies would actually naturally pair together well. For example, if you said something like, women are incompetent and can't take care of themselves, which is why they need to be protected and watched over by men. So contrary to this idea that they would actually be shown in different kinds of people, they actually seem to go together more often than not, and they're correlated very highly.
Yeah, and a lot of women, I think, have experienced having somebody say something condescending and benevolent to you, you resisting, and they suddenly getting hostile.
Right, right. And another aspect of benevolent sexism that can be particularly damaging is that it typically only holds these idealized positive views of women who happen to be in very traditional gender roles. But as soon as women attempt to step outside of these roles, maybe by running for office or by attempting to gain power in the workplace or acting in any way that doesn't necessarily fit with these traditional gender stereotypes, that's when you, as you said, that's when you see that flip from benevolent towards hostile, where it's like, well, I was going to protect you, I was going to be nice to you, but if you're not going to appreciate it, then screw you, I hate women. So you can see that flip come almost very surprisingly at times, because there's this underlying idea that women should only be appreciated and protected and looked after if they're behaving the right way.
Beyond just hostile sexism and the correlation, does benevolent sexism have its own negative, measurable results?
Yes. So in some of the studies that I was just mentioning and referring to, researchers have looked at benevolent and hostile sexism as independent predictors of, for example, nationwide gender inequality measures. So there's two measures collected by, I believe, the United Nations that measure things like life expectancy rates, literacy rates, education levels, purchasing power, participation in political and economic spheres, things like that, measure the difference between men and women in those regards, and then computes this gender inequality index. It essentially says, aggregating all these things together, how well is the country doing? Are the two genders pretty equal on all of those metrics, or are they very different from each other? And even when you control for the effects of hostile sexism, so even when you take hostile sexism completely out of the equation, the amount that you see people in certain countries tending to endorse benevolent sexism, that's actually an independent predictor of those levels of gender inequality. So it's not just the hostile sexism that's predicting it, it's the benevolent sexism independently as well.
The reason your piece kind of inadvertently was timely was that right after you wrote it, President Obama was subject to a lot of criticism for calling California's Attorney General Kamala Harris the best-looking attorney general in the country. How do you feel about the criticisms of his comments?
I have some mixed feelings about it, actually, because I worry at times. So I'm the first one to want to call out when I see things happening in society and people behaving in ways that I don't think are best. And I don't necessarily want to give Obama a pass or an excuse because I happen to like him and have voted for him and like his policies. But at the same time, I worry sometimes when I see some people, I mean, people on the internet can be a little bit crazy, myself, but not any of the people I've been talking to recently about this, but, you know, you see people sometimes. And sometimes you see people sort of taking it to that next level, demonizing people that you see making these remarks and being very quick to point fingers and say, like, you're a sexist, you're a bad person. And I think that's something that you brought up in your piece that I really appreciated is that it's not necessarily that Obama himself is a sexist, but that his remark is reflective of a larger cultural problem, which I think really gets at it perfectly. I think that what his remark shows is not necessarily that Obama's a bad person. I don't think that. I don't think that most people I know think that, and I think that most people aren't going to change their opinion of him one way or another because of one remark, and they shouldn't. But I think that what it shows is that even someone who has shown himself to be very objectively over the past 5 years of his presidency to care a lot about women's issues, to take a very forward-thinking view on policies that affect women, and to be very pro-woman in his explicit policies, you can still see these cultural effects of benevolently sexist stereotypes. And the thing that we see worth commenting about men and women, you can even see those start to leak out in, for example, what someone would naturally find worth complimenting about a professional woman. So I think that it actually served to prove a very good point that you don't need to be a terrible person in order to sort of inadvertently demonstrate the problem with some of these underlying cultural ideas. So just the fact that when you go to compliment a woman, it might seem natural to say something about her appearance, as opposed to when you go to say something about a man, it's not the first thing that pops into your head. I don't think there's something about him as an individual as much as it says something about how we've all been socialized to view men and women, and in particular, how we've been socialized to view men and women professionals. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So in your article, you also talked a little bit about how benevolent sexism kind of can work in politics. And one thing I thought was interesting was you see that a lot when it comes to the reproductive rights issue. For instance, mm-hmm. in Gonzalez versus Carhart, Justice Anthony Kennedy defended the ban on later term abortions on the grounds that it was for women's own good because they don't know if they'll later regret it. There's a lot of laws that are like mandatory waiting periods and ultrasounds for abortions that feed into the stereotype that women are kind of fickle and they don't know their minds. Can you comment on the role of benevolent sexism here?
I think, and I hate to use the term slippery slope because I feel like it's one that gets thrown around all of the time, but regardless, I think that that seems to be what's at play here, and I think that it demonstrates very well how you can see positive attitudes or things that seem positive, such as thinking, oh, I want to look out for women. I think they should be protected. I think they should be looked after, as something that can sort of slide into this idea of, oh, well, we have to make decisions for them because they're not capable of acting on their own behalf. So I think it demonstrates very well how you can see something that seems harmless start to snowball into something that's decidedly more dangerous.
My guest today has been Melanie Tannenbaum. You can follow her blogging at the Scientific American blog. It's at blogs.scientificamerican.com/PSY Society. That's PSY Society. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Melanie. I got love for you if you were born
in the 80s. I don't get to cover good news on this podcast very much, so I'm thrilled to tell you that we have a major victory for reason and science over the forces of misogyny and sexual phobia. Secretary Kathleen Sebelius took unprecedented action in December 2011, overruling the FDA's decision to allow Plan B emergency contraception to be sold over-the-counter in pharmacies without an ID. Well, now a federal judge has issued an order requiring that Sebelius rescind the decision.
Well, U.S. District Judge Edward Corman, who's actually had this suit before him in one form or another for more than 8 years, has technically ordered the Food and Drug Administration to approve a citizen's petition asking that the morning after pill be made available to all women without a prescription, regardless of age, within 30 days.
Okay, and how is that different from what happens in a drugstore now?
Well, now the drug is available without a prescription to those 17 and older. But if you're 16 and younger, you do need a doctor's order. Notice I didn't say it's available over the counter to those 17 and older. That's because it's kept what's known as behind the counter, which means that women need to ask for it. Usually they have to show ID. And there have been a lot of cases reported where even adults have had a hard time getting it. In some cases, pharmacists have incorrectly thought they can't sell it to boyfriends or husbands.
The science is in. The pills are safe. They aren't abortion, like opponents claim. And research shows that younger teens are perfectly capable of following the instructions on the package. It is, after all, one pill you take after unprotected sex. A pair of shoes could figure it out. But even if you're skeptical, there was plenty of research and expert opinion offered to the FDA that they used to determine that Plan B could be safely sold over the counter. And even though the Obama administration prides itself on putting evidence and science before political considerations, they blew right past all that research to make the fear-based arguments with no basis in reality for refusing to let the FDA do its job.
Which naturally brought forth allegations the administration was putting politics above science. This decision did, after all, approximately coincide with the start of the 2012 presidential campaign. But the reason the Obama administration gave for overruling the science behind the FDA decision was essentially some girls start their periods early. Quote, about 10% of girls are physically capable of bearing children by 11.1 years of age. It is common knowledge that there are significant cognitive and behavioral differences between older adolescent girls and the youngest girls of reproductive age. If the application were approved, the product would be available without prescription for all girls of reproductive age. That explanation did not impress the New England Journal of Medicine. In our opinion, the secretary's decision to retain behind-the-counter status for Plan B one step was based on politics rather than science. It cannot be based on issues of safety, since a 12-year-old can purchase a lethal dose of acetaminophen in any pharmacy for about $11. No questions asked.
In addition, there's common sense. If you think a single dose of hormones is dangerous for an 11-year-old, why on earth do you think that the alternative, which is a potential unwanted pregnancy, is preferable? That just defies reason. Like the New England Journal of Medicine, I'm forced to conclude that the decision was pure politics, mostly the president not wanting to have a bunch of accusations about aiding and abetting junior high school kids' sex lives during a campaign season. They also said that Plan B appears to be more dangerous for politicians than for adolescent girls. Luckily for all of us, the judge on this case came to the same conclusions.
He weighed in himself, too, writing that the motivation for the secretary's action was obviously political, and even with eyes shut to the motivation for the secretary's decision, the reasons she provided are so unpersuasive as to call into question her good faith. He found that it is hardly clear that the secretary had the power to issue the order, and if she did have the authority, her decision was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable. And he reversed that decision, ordering the FDA to make emergency birth control available without a prescription and without point-of-sale age restrictions within 30 days.
The smart thing for the White House to do now is let it go. They got their re-election without having to deal with this, and this judge has given them an opportunity to save face. Unfortunately, the first statement we have on the record about this is from the White House Press Secretary Jay Carney, who said the president stands by the decision just as he did back then to restrict emergency contraception. Of course, there's always a chance they're just saying that, and they won't drag this out any further by appealing the decision. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, because wife beating is apparently not deviant behavior edition. Tom DeLay, who is apparently out on bail, has been doing the rounds on the conservative speaking tour and complaining about the Violence Against Women Act.
In the same week they passed the violence against the Senate's bill, Violence Against Women's Act, that includes homosexuality, transgender, setting up all kinds of different classes of sexual deviance. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing that they did that. And they fashioned a rule so it'd be easier to pass that the Senate bill, which is a wacko leftist bill.
Make no mistake, this argument casts homosexuality as a behavior that's supposedly so deviant that one should turn a blind eye to domestic violence rather than treat LGBT people as full human beings. It literally casts being LGBT as more deviant than wife beating or rape. Think about that.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.